Philip Morgan.
Listen, Witherill.
How's it going, sir?
I'm pretty good. I'm tired. I've been working hard on a side project for my wife, which is helping her produce a podcast that she has been commissioned to produce. So I've been editing audio and putting in music and tastefully writing sponsor reads. And I bet you didn't listen to the episode I sent you, but yeah, that's what I'm up to. What are you up to?
No, I haven't, but thanks for putting me on blast right here on the air.
I'm pretty good at that.
So side projects, I'm subscribed to this email list of this company called FE International. Terrible, terrible name. But what they do is they broker internet properties.
Right.
And so if you have a website or an app that you want to sell, they'll broker it.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll put it out to their list. And so I look at these listings. Have you ever done this?
You mentioned this to me years ago, and I signed up for their list on your recommendation, and it was interesting for a while. It's not as much my thing, so I think I eventually unsubscribed, but yeah, I've seen their stuff.
Well, I think it's fascinating because it's like full of side projects. Of course, most of them are for them to market a listing. They want to make, I guess they get like 20% of the listing or something, so they want it to be rather expensive. But speaking of side projects, I often look at those and go, huh, I wonder if I could do that part-time as a side project. But then I often go, God, that seems like such a time suck.
That seems like very much not part-time.
I think the hard thing about seeing those is if there were technical issues, I wouldn't be able to address them or even know how to hire the people who could address them. And that's usually where it all falls apart for me.
Here's my question about that.
Anything.
I would expect you would see patterns of some kind, like, I mean, maybe the pattern is this is the kind of business people want to get rid of. And so it's like kind of an anti-pattern. But have you noticed anything in like looking at these over time of, wow, this kind of business seems like a great opportunity, or people seem to be able to make this work at least up to a point over and over again?
Yeah. So every time I see one of these listings, it always brings into question, what's the motivation of the buyer to sell this? If it's so great, because like they spend all this time in the prospectus making it sound like it's such a great deal. And
yeah, then why are you selling?
Yeah, but of course someone's getting rid of it.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, what's behind that?
Yeah.
There are a few different things. I think one is a lot of people will plateau or see declining revenue. And they'll just kind of throw their hands up and go, I might as well just take my money off the table.
Uh-huh, yeah.
I think there's also a lot of circumstances where they entered a market that was open at the time, and they start to get encroached upon from a lot of different directions.
Right.
So I'll give you an example. I was looking at one this week or last week, and it's a learning management system for wait staff, which is a nice little niche. So they sell to restaurants and you can draw from their library of content to train a waiter to upsell, for instance, right?
Sure.
Like dessert or drinks or something like that.
Yeah.
But as I thought about that business, because I think that's an interesting niche, but as I thought about this business, I was like, well, how many learning management systems are there? Really, the only thing unique about this is they have some content already and it's for restaurants. But
yeah,
there's a million different ways that you can manage that content.
Yeah.
So I think that's a common one, is they went into a market, it seemed open. Maybe also they built some tech around solving a problem in one area, and then they generalized the tech and resold that elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're like, oh, we want to get rid of this very particular property. So yeah, I see some patterns, but I'm always not suspicious, but curious, why get rid of this? Here's one pattern I see a lot, to answer your question more directly, is owners will be running two or three little projects like this,
mm-hmm.
and one of them will be taking off. And so they'll get rid of the one that's just not, they're either not as interested in or isn't growing as fast.
They're culling the herd. Yeah, that makes sense. Interesting. Makes me, my wife and I occasionally will, when there's like an open house, we'll go check it out. We always ask, like, why are they selling? I think you can tell when it's actually a divorce, but the agent doesn't want to say that.
Why not? What's so bad about that?
I don't know. It's just, there's a little sense of like, obfuscation in their response. And they'll say something like, oh, yeah, they're just life or too much going on, or they already have another house or whatever. And because there's a fair number of people here who have vacation houses here in West Sonoma County. Anyway, you just get a sense that there's a reason they give you and then there's the real reason they're selling.
Well, my buddy got all the way to almost signing papers and going into escrow on a house. And then at the final disclosure, they disclosed that there was like a triple homicide in the house like a few years earlier.
Was that California where you have to disclose that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was like, I think I'll pass on this one.
You would think that they would bring that up earlier, sort of like a sales conversation, right? Where you might probe proactively for objections if you're just pretty sure they're there anyway and they're going to kill the deal. Like, wouldn't you want to be in control of that if you were the selling agent? Instead of getting through all this process, all this time has gone by, mm-hmm. The seller is in a volume game. So why wouldn't they just say, hey, look, we just want to let you know this happened before we waste anybody's time here.
Well, I definitely wouldn't recommend getting all the way to the 11th hour and then bringing up a huge bombshell like that. I agree with that.
Yeah.
I guess the other mindset is, well, let's get them to fall in love with the house and hopefully they'll be able to swallow this horrible pill. I don't know. I agree with you. I would err on the side of disclosing that faster.
On that note, I don't know if it's Tim Williams or Ronald Baker, somebody in the sort of like providing advice around sales for agencies game says the following about the RFP process. He says it is often intentionally this convoluted, torturous process so that the vendor gets bought into it and invested in it, and then loss aversion kicks in so that the buyer can extract price concessions because of that loss aversion, because they've put so much sunk cost into this that they don't want to lose that sunk cost, they being the vendor. Have you ever heard that before?
I think the psychology is right. I agree with the psychology of it. I don't think most people do the RFP process for the reason to take advantage of vendors. But if you're in procurement and your only job is to hire people over and over, yeah, maybe you do that just to like have a little wicked fun.
Yeah.
I'd call you an asshole to your face if you treat people like that, but I guess I wouldn't put it past people.
It was described not as like as the guilty pleasure, but more as like as just a pressure tactic to get price concessions.
Do I understand correctly that he's saying the reason that they do the RFP process, or one of the reasons they make it so complicated, is to have pricing leverage at the end? Is that correct?
That, I believe, was how it was explained, yeah.
I don't agree with that. I think he's right that you have more pricing leverage if your RFP process sucks, because if someone makes it all the way to the end, because I've been in this position before.
That's why I ask. Yeah, you were doing that for that big consulting company, right? You guys were responding to RFPs.
We respond to an RFP and you're like, God, that thing was so horrible. I have no idea if I understood it. They wouldn't directly answer our questions. And like governments would make you write in with your questions and then they'd answer them to everybody, which is like, there are all kinds of reasons why that sucks. You go into it thinking like, I don't think this one's going to work out. And then you make it to the 11th hour and you're like, wow, holy crap. And then you do want the deal at that point.
Yeah.
Agreed, because of the sunk cost fallacy. Because you're like, I put so much time into it. I didn't think we were going to win this. Depending on the timing of your pipeline, you may be like, I don't have any other revenue on the horizon. I'd love to bring this in.
Right. We're one of the finalists. Yada, yada. Yeah.
But what I would say is, even if the process wasn't convoluted, you still make the same upfront investment to write a proposal that's that complicated. And so even if it's totally straightforward and you understood it the whole time, it's still going to take a long time. You're still putting a tremendous amount of effort. No matter what their intention was originally, that psychology still exists with the sunk cost, right? Because you're like, and I've seen this before, when I was at the solar company, the president would get in advanced discussions and for larger projects, and he cut the price, and we'd be like, well, we're losing money on that deal.
Yeah.
And he's like, but it's $800,000. And it's like, no, it's not. It's minus $100,000.
Right. Yeah.
Like, it's not $800,000. Like, that's all going to product and then some. I think it's a common pressure, and I think it just, the larger the projects and the more difficult, or maybe not more difficult, the more competitive the process to win the deal, the more pricing pressure the hiring party will have. That's my opinion, generally.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. It does seem a little like conspiracy theory-ish in its convenience to say, oh, that's just, they made the process unnecessarily convoluted, because what little I know of RFPs is, it seems like they just naturally become complex and convoluted and lengthy processes. Like, the design of the whole process creates that anyway. So we've made it to the 10-minute mark without introducing the show. So, success.
Yes. Congratulations.
Do you have anything that you want to pitch today for the offline podcasts, where two online consultants get together to be pseudo offline?
Sure. Yeah. I think the only thing I would pitch is, if you are, not you, Philip, but you, dear listener, if you're having any issues with selling and you're thinking you need some help on growing your practice, I'd love to talk to you. You can apply for a strategy call with me. All you have to do is go to liston.io/strategy. I'll ask you a few questions there. You can let me know what your response is. And if I think that there's a fit for us to work together, I will send you a scheduling link. And if not, I'll send you a bunch of free shit that you can consume and never pay me a dime. But either way, I would love to have the opportunity to meet you and potentially chat with you. So just go to liston.io/strategy. Philip, it's your turn. What are you pitching today, sir?
You know, I put together a new email course that lays out my thinking about how coders become consultants. You can sign up for it if you want, dear listener, at coder2consultant.com. That's the numeral.
Is that the number two?
Yeah.
Or T-O?
You got me. It's the numeral two. So that row of keys at the top of the keyboard, not T-O. Huh. coder2consultant.com. You can sign up there. And I think it might be valuable to sign up if that's a transition that you're wanting to make in your own career, because I think it'll give you a sort of framework for how you can execute that transition. It's not easy, but the people that do it tend to do so in fairly repeatable ways, and that framework is what I'm describing there. So coder2consultant.com.
Excellent. And today, Philip, we are going to talk about something that I get really sort of unnecessarily energized about. I'm not sure why.
Do you get worked up about this?
I do, actually. Maybe it'll happen.
Sweet.
On the show, I've had plenty of coffee to increase the likelihood that I'll get all worked up while we're talking about it.
I'm going to get you all lathered up about this. Good.
Yes. So today's topic is road mapping. Should you use it? Does it have kind of a short-term time frame built into it? Is it playing the long game? Is it the short game? When is it right for you? And I have lots of thoughts on all of these things. Maybe the best thing to do is first describe what we mean by road mapping. So in a service business, one of the hardest things to do is to be different, is to differentiate yourself. This is why your business exists, Philip, is to help people solve that problem, to differentiate and specialize.
Yes.
And tied to that issue is reluctance and hesitation to buy, right? Because I, the buyer, am taking on some risk when I buy from you. And one way that we as sellers can alleviate that pressure is to sell something smaller. So instead of selling the $100,000 engagement, we could sell a $10,000 engagement.
Yeah.
And usually that is something along the lines of the strategic or planning work that needs to go into the bigger project. And that is sometimes called road mapping. Do you agree with me so far?
I do. It's also called paid discovery sometimes. So it goes under a number of names, or it might be the discovery phase of a project. Those are the common names for it.
Fun fact, in Sandler training, they would call this the monkey paw.
Seriously?
Yes. Which I think is a term that comes from ships, where they would throw the rope and it would have like something on the end of the rope to like attach to the dock.
Oh, okay. I was intrigued by that, but thought it was some sort of cheesy horror movie reference.
Yeah, no, it's not. Or like the Simpsons Halloween special with the monkey hand.
Yeah, right.
No, it's not. But so anyway, the idea basically being if you can have a low-cost way of people working with you initially, then you have a greater likelihood of getting the larger project that you want to sell to them.
Right.
Here's the thing, though, is I believe this idea, and maybe this is where I'll start to get worked up, I believe that this idea has been dramatically oversimplified and overapplied. I think it doesn't apply to the majority of people working as consultants.
Hmm.
That's my thought.
Bold talk for a geezer. Sorry, trying to quote a line from True Grit. Anyway, why do you think that?
So here's the thing. One reason that it's good to sell a road mapping session is it will give you an idea. So this is how it's often pitched through marketing, is sell the roadmap because then you'll get an idea of how serious the buyer is.
Yeah.
Of course, it's the better reason to do it is the buyer is reluctant, and therefore you give them kind of an easier way of doing business with you and get to know you. But that's usually when I read about road mapping, it's not from that perspective. It's like, see if the buyer is worth your time. Otherwise, they're an asshole. Now, if you're selling something that's inexpensive, relatively, let's say $5,000 to $10,000 range, typically it's recommended to sell the roadmap at 10 to 20% of the greater engagement. So if you're selling something for, let's say, $10,000 and your roadmap is $1,000, to me, someone willing to pay $1,000 isn't necessarily the same person who's willing to pay $10,000. I don't think. I think that's a big leap.
Okay, so you're saying it's not a good way to like assess the client's spending power?
Right. So if your concern is, I don't know if this person has the money or the willingness to pay for the bigger project.
Okay.
I don't think $1,000 is going to demonstrate a willingness to pay $10,000.
It seems to me like the main thrust of how I've seen road mapping or paid discovery described is more of a risk mitigation strategy than like a way to assess buying power. So we might be attacking a straw man there, but also I agree with your point. What do you say about this as a tool for managing risk, for basically saying, let's not go to a full project until we understand the problem? Like that might be the best way of framing it, right?
Yeah. So I don't want to get into a semantic argument, but I think that nobody like wants a map. Right? I think the idea on its own is not great to begin with.
Can you elaborate on that? Nobody, because I think that you might be right, and that might be huge. Like, nobody wants a map. What do you mean? They want the result, not the map. They want the gold, the buried treasure, not the map that tells them where it is.
Well, they want the map, and they want, like, GPS, and they want, like, an ETA, right? Like, they want all of those things. That's my feeling, is they don't just want this tool that is great if you have all of these skills that you can use to apply it. They want something that goes a little bit farther than that. That's my feeling.
And I should elaborate there that one of the benefits that's attached to this idea of paid discovery is you, dear client, can pay me or my company this smaller amount of money than what you were thinking this project would cost. And we will do some discovery and problem solving and maybe some light design work and some planning work. And then you can take the result of that, the plan, the map that you were just talking about, Liston, and you can hire us to implement it, or you can implement it yourself, or you can go to somebody cheaper and they'll implement it. You're saying that that benefit is not really all that big from the buyer side.
I don't think it's very realistic. I've sold that way, and I think there's some folly in it, right? So I think if I say to you, I'll create the strategy, you can take it to anyone else.
How valuable is it if somebody else implements this strategy they didn't come up with?
Well, so if someone came to me and said, hey, I had this other company do a strategy, would you just do it for me? I would say no, right? I'd say, no, I don't work like that. Like, I need to make sure that the strategy is right first. So no, I wouldn't do that.
But to be fair, earlier in my career, I would have been like, oh, okay, because, you know, I wanted the work. And I was doing pure implementation work.
I agree with you. It depends on where you are in your career. But My feeling is if you're doing higher end strategic consulting work, it's not really like they would look for someone else like you if the engagement failed. That strategy wouldn't be really worthwhile, is my opinion.
Yeah, it's like a false benefit in that situation. The portability of the plan is not all that awesome in practice, is what I think you're saying.
Right. And so I think a roadmap is valuable if the client also experiences some process, if it's not just a deliverable, if you're putting them through a process that helps them improve their thinking or decision-making, improve their understanding of their business, improve their strategic outlook of what's going on, that makes a difference. But if you're just giving them a document, to me, that's not really helping the client. The other thing I would say is if you have this like 10 or 20% number in mind, I want to sell them a $10,000 thing. So let's start with two. Mm-hmm. My question to you is, will that $2,000 thing actually be useful to move them closer to the goal that they want? And if the answer is no, don't sell it to them.
I think that's huge. I mean, that might be the sort of strongest argument I've heard from you thus far, is that it's just, maybe it's just not good for the client to structure the service delivery this way. Do you think there are cases where it is good for the client, though?
Yeah, I mean, I do. So like today, you could argue that I was selling a road mapping service, but kind of not really.
Hypocrite!
Well, so...
I'm joking, of course.
As I'm looking more at agencies and helping them scale their growth, like I'm not going to do any implementation or coaching without really understanding what's going on and what opportunities they have. So we really do need to put a plan together. I would argue that's my core deliverable, not a roadmap. But in that scenario, if I'm going to say, hey, like you're looking for the growth levers to pull, there's no way for me to know what those are unless I do some digging and some homework and maybe a little bit of implementation and really get you started on this road. And I'm not going to offer you coaching until we do that. That to me feels a lot like a roadmap. However, pricing wise, it's priced higher than my coaching, or at least it would be many months of coaching before it equaled the plan that they're going to get.
Oh, interesting. So it's sort of like an upfront fee. And is the expectation when you're presenting that to a client that they go together? The one is not portable, and like the plan is not really something that you could just take someplace else. You're not emphasizing that aspect of it. In other words,
I'm not.
When I think about road mapping, I think one of the things that the person selling road mapping would do is bend over backwards to say, this is like a first date. We're not getting married here. If you don't like working with us, me, you don't like the results of this plan, or you do like it, but you just think we're too expensive to implement it, then you can take it somewhere else. You're not really emphasizing the portability of your plan. You're sort of selling it as the first phase in a multi-phase thing.
That is what I'm selling it as. I'm saying like phase one is you need the plan. Phase two is I offer training, workshops, coaching that you can consume for yourself or for your team. And if you want implementation done, I have partners who can do that.
Right.
But without the plan, like we don't know, even know where to put our efforts in the future.
I think that's a meaningful difference, though. The way I see most people conceive of road mapping is it's this first phase that is like modular. And what you're describing is it's the first phase, but it's not modular that way. It's just the first phase. And the expectation is we're going to start with that first phase and then keep going into subsequent phases so that you can get the greatest benefit from this whole thing.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't know how big of a difference that is. Here's the other thing I'd say about road mapping is it tends to work really well if your projects are very expensive, right? So I believe that the real genesis of this idea came from paid discovery. So I always think about the show Mad Men, and I know you didn't watch that, but...
Yeah, I did.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Okay, so you remember the episodes where they would do like the big pitch for Lucky Strike or for the airline?
Yeah.
And it was like 12 people in a room assembling three different campaign styles, doing the creative, doing ads and radio spots. And like, I mean, they basically did the work already, right? And they were going to charge them on the back end for, now we'll just do this every month. But basically, they did all the hard creative work.
Right.
To me, the genesis or the original idea behind road mapping was you should get paid for that part of it.
Right.
So like you said, you called it paid discovery, but I would even say, like, let's sort of come up with some ideas together and you have to invest in this just as we're going to, mm-hmm. and sort of share the risk of the project. But if the implementation is going to cost $200,000 a month for an ad agency, maybe you charge them $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 just to come up with, like, what is the high level plan that we might put together? And that substantially de-risks it for your client, mm-hmm. and gets them invested. That to me seems like a really good use of it. What's not a good use is if you're selling a $5,000 website and you want to charge $500 for a 1 hour strategy call. To me, that's just like, I don't know. Don't you just want the $5,000? Like, how helpful is that to your client?
Yeah, because there's a risk management function when it's being used well. And like you point out, when it's, it would actually add risk, I think, in the case of the $5,000 website, because it delay, you know, it extends the timeline. There's more moving parts. There's more meetings to coordinate, perhaps. There's maybe a sense of like less commitment from the client, like, oh, we're just trying this person out. It's just $500. So I think you could make the argument that it actually adds risk in that case. Jumping back a little bit, you got me thinking about this idea that the ad industry had a model that let them amortize the cost that they bore on the agency side of developing creative. They could roll that into the cost of media management and, you know, all that stuff.
Because they get paid 20% of the ad buy or something, which is not that expensive to manage and scales well.
Right. So with that, you could essentially do the creative for free. And I wonder if that kind of set the tone for how a lot of freelancers think, where, like Blair ends, I'm against the idea of pitching when you're not paid if the pitching is totally custom to each client. But that's exactly what the ad industry was doing. And I wonder if that's where that came from. It's the first time I've really thought about that.
Well, I assume that, but I don't actually know.
When I started freelancing, I just kind of assumed that you would put on a dog and pony show for clients. It was assumption, and I'm not sure where that came from. So now I'm wondering if it's the ad industry that made me believe that.
Yeah, I don't know. Because back in the day, in general, I'd say sellers had more power than buyers relative to where we are now, where buyers have way more power because the cost of research and finding alternatives is pretty close to zero.
Yeah.
Whereas before, they didn't have that power. However, if you're a large ad agency and Lucky Strike is looking for a new agency, there's only like 3 to 5 firms that they would hire. So you're always in a competitive environment there. So maybe it did come from that agencies. I don't know.
Interesting.
That was the example that I always thought about. So yeah, I think it unnecessarily complicates things. It's not in the best interest of the buyer in a lot of cases. Like you said, it adds risk. It adds complication. It slows down the project. So my feeling is, if you're having a hard time selling, there may be something wrong with your offer. There may be something wrong with your marketing. You may be talking to the wrong people. There could be lots of other things going on before I would start saying what you really need is a road mapping project.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like in the top 5 for me.
Yeah. And there are alternate models, like in the world of software, there's the whole lean development model, which I'm not convinced I've ever actually seen that implemented the way it quote unquote should be, or in a sort of picture perfect way. But that's another risk management approach that can be used instead of something like road mapping. I guess after hearing all your complaints about it, and I'm just so disappointed you're not foaming at the mouth at this point. I have not properly played the devil's advocate in this conversation.
Uh-huh.
But you know, after hearing you lay this all out, I think the biggest issue that I have currently with it is this presumed portability of the plan, because more and more I'm just sort of willing to cop to the fact that I'm not here to help all freelancers. I'm not here to help all software developers. I'm really interested in helping the ones that want to become operating like consultants and develop real expertise. So when I think about somebody like that implementing road mapping, their process should have some unique proprietary aspects to it that not just any company could implement the results of that diagnostic process. Mm-hmm. So it really does lead me to think that this whole idea of the portability of the roadmap is kind of not suitable for the people that I'm working with.
Okay, so let's talk in the positive then. Who is it suitable for, in your opinion?
Well, I agree. Bigger projects, more complex projects. Maybe it's a little bit of a straw man argument, the $5,000 website, but that's a great example of where it would not be a good suitable tool. So I think just generally bigger, more complex projects, those would need to be multi-phase projects anyway.
Exactly. So I don't know if that's semantic or not, but I would just call, like, what is the minimum that you would need to do in phase one in order to advance this thing forward and just break that apart into the first part of the engagement?
Right. In software, you might move from like discovery or into some sort of design work or a proof of concept or a prototype or something like that. Or in a more lean methodology, just like the first like release of the software, the first sprint where you have some incredibly basic functionality, like a, I don't know, a login screen or something like that. It's a gray area. Like, do you call that road mapping? Like, why does it need a separate term? It's a way of managing risk, I guess, is how I'm seeing it more and more. I guess there's one thing we haven't touched on, which is that there are plenty of clients who want to rush into implementation. Mm-hmm. They want like to see stuff getting built. They want to see the sawdust flying and they want to see implementation happening without a proper design process. It's sort of like telling a contractor, no, we don't have any floor plans, but I want you to get over to Home Depot and get some materials and start building this thing and we'll figure it out as we go. I do think in that case, maybe it's useful to have this sort of spiel of like, that's a great way to waste a lot of your money. Let's insert this other thing that we do at the beginning of projects where we figure things out. Let's do that first. So maybe it's useful in that sense to kind of have something in your back pocket that you can put in front of a client that is it's a process, it has a name. I don't see why you would have to call it road mapping. You could call it paid discovery or whatever. Mm-hmm. Anyway, like there's that. There's plenty of clients who are like rushing to implement and it's like a ready fire aim instead of a ready aim fire situation.
If the core of your business is doing implementation work though, yeah, I have lots of thoughts on that. I guess my feeling is if you need to do strategic work before implementation work, just don't allow your client to bully you into that. You just say, sorry, I don't work that way.
Right.
And that's the end of the discussion. Right? Like, should we keep talking? And if they say no, then you say, great. What is it? I'm the first choice on your second hire for this particular job.
Oh, that was so good.
Yeah. So like when it doesn't work out on Upwork or Fiverr, wherever you go, like come back to me and I'll be ready.
I'll be here.
I agree with that. You know, one company that I was thinking about that Brennan Dunn talks about a lot, or at least I think was involved in his road mapping course, was this Neon Roots and Rootstrap. And so road mapping works. Here's what I don't like is when it's forced and it's an unnatural break in the way you divide your projects and it doesn't benefit the client. But for Neon Roots that does app development projects to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars, it makes sense to pay $10,000 or $20,000 for them to come up with a plan and a prototype and like a interactive wireframe. So you get a sense of what it looks like and you can go out and raise money or convince your investors, hey, we're ready to spend these hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
That totally makes sense. That's a perfect use of it. But again, to me, that's just like a phase of the project that you'd have to do anyway.
Yeah. And with software, I think it's possible in that early phase to deliver something more functional or more useful or more effective than a written plan. Like it could be some design work or it could be a mock-up or it could be a prototype or a proof of concept. So the idea that you're going to deliver a written report, that's, I don't think either you or I have used those words yet in this conversation, but that's also, I think, what a lot of people think when they think about road mapping is it's like it's going to be a report. And maybe there's something more useful that could be delivered. Maybe in a pure design project, it would be research that would be done first. And that would be the first phase. I'm jumping back here. This is I had to go look in Slack while you're talking. This is the exact tagline you were talking about. This is for some marketing automation software. Net results is the first choice of people buying marketing automation for the second time.
That is such a great...
That's beautiful. It's memorable. It just says a lot. It's very clever.
That's it. I'm switching, Philip. I'm switching my marketing automation just because that tagline is so good.
Well, I thought you were going to say, Liston Witherill, the first choice of people who are hiring a sales coach for the second time.
It was going to be Liston Witherill, the first option when all other options are exhausted.
Wait, doesn't that mean that you're the last option?
Yes, it was a joke.
I'm your last resort.
I'm self-deprecating here, Philip.
Liston Witherill, when everything else didn't work and you still are trying.
Yeah, I think it's a funny tagline. Yeah, net results is the first choice of people buying marketing automation for the second time. Marketers who know what they need choose net results.
That's pretty good. It's like you screwed it up the first time. Now you're going to get it right.
I've never heard of this company.
Yeah, I haven't either, to be honest.
Yeah, interesting. Here's what I would summarize for my thoughts on road mapping. Mm-hmm. Number one is it has to be in the best interest of the client. And it, in order to do a roadmap that works for you and the client, it would have to be a natural break or phase one of the project anyways.
Yeah.
But don't just do it because you think it's easier to sell something lower priced. That's not in the best interest of the client. And you really, as a service provider, that's what you are. You should never do something that benefits you, but not the client. That's just like not a good thing to do.
Yeah.
And if you're selling really expensive things, it could be a great way for people to try you out and for you to try them out also. That's not something we mentioned, but you may be reluctant to work with someone to the tune of $250,000 or something, whatever your large engagements are. So it gives you a chance to try them out just as they get a chance to try you out. So that's what I would say about road mapping, Philip.
Yeah, another benefit that's associated with road mapping that we didn't talk about is it's getting paid to write a proposal. That's another way I've heard it conceived of and described.
Right.
I guess I have mixed feelings on that. On the one hand, I'm like, I don't know. I mean, what do you think about that? Actually, I'm trying to formulate my thoughts about that. There's nothing wrong with it. I just am always thinking about like, what does that say about your expertise if you are that uncertain about what it's going to take? And I know that there are plenty of projects where that's just how it goes. You can't get the uncertainty out of it until you're part or all the way through it.
All right. So I have a lot of thoughts on this, right? So like in some industries, if you're selling to the government, like you'll never get paid to write a proposal. That's just not how it works.
Yeah.
Right? That's just part of the way the business is structured, which is why I don't sell to the government because I don't want to write a proposal like that. I find it mind-numbing.
Oh, that Hinge marketing study said a lot of the higher growth professional services firms do sell to the government.
Well, right. And that makes sense because if you land one government contract, it's easy to bump your revenue by 20% because government contracts tend to be very big.
Yeah. Another way of saying that is there's like a little wink built into it of, okay, you put up with this terrible procurement process and then you can overcharge us, basically.
Maybe.
You don't think so?
Well, it's still competitive. So like in the construction industry, like you have to even divulge your margins. And of course, there's creative accounting things that people do, but still, it's not like a free-for-all the way it's portrayed in the media, at least not most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing I would say about getting paid to write a proposal is if the proposal that they want is actually that complicated, mm-hmm. that you're not capable of writing it without feeling like you should be compensated, to me, that's work, yeah. Right? And you should get paid to do work. You shouldn't get paid, in my opinion, to run your sales process to a reasonable degree. So have a conversation about why they need that level of detail and whether or not they're willing to pay for it. And if not, then don't do it. But it's totally in bounds to say, actually, what you're asking for, those are things we would uncover once we engage. Here's what I would include in the proposal. How does that sound? And I find that a lot of people want to turn to all these tricky things, road mapping being one of many tricks that I would include in that basket, because they're avoiding having conversations where they feel like they might be delivering bad news, like, hey, I'm not willing to do that. And here's why. And I think that you should really just have that conversation, and that makes it a lot easier.
Doesn't it sound so simple when you say it that way?
I guess. Like, I'm not trying to make it sound like, you know, it's so easy, but it's definitely easier than writing the proposal.
Yeah. No, simple and easy are not the same thing. But like, simple is like, hey, just say, well, that's not really going to help. Mm-hmm. Or I just don't do that. Or that level of detail is actually, all those details are going to be sort of shifted or figured out in the early part of this process. So seeing them in a proposal is not going to add value. Or basically just helping them understand what really is necessary to get the best results. Mm-hmm. Another thing that occurs to me on this idea of like, oh, proposals are so costly to do, is that's an artifact of low profitability. Like if you're in a business where you really do have to create these high effort proposals, these elaborate, beautiful, amazing, or complex proposals, that's a cost that comes out of profitability. And if that creates tension, then maybe there's a profitability problem rather than another problem that needs to be solved by charging for the proposal.
So I think that's part of it. I would also say, like, you should ask the client, if I go spend 20 hours writing this proposal, how is that going to help you make a decision? Because one thing that could definitely be happening is the reason you're being asked to write these ridiculous tomes that a lot of us call proposals is because you haven't adequately built the trust and credibility with the client in the first place. And so you've shifted your marketing debt into your proposal process. And you think people are sold on you, but they're actually not, which is why they need to see 20 or 30 pages. But the question is, how will that actually help them make a decision? And I think a lot of times it probably won't. Maybe they are just scared to blow you off. And this is like a blow off tactic. And who hasn't written a proposal when really they were being blown off? I mean, I have for sure.
Yeah, we all have.
Right. But we would like to avoid that.
Yeah, that's a great way to frame it. And now I'm getting some of that fire that I was hoping for out of you. So you talked about marketing debt. And that reminds me of something else I wanted to say about this, which is one way that the road mapping is thought of is it's like a first date, but the client is paying for the first date, right? The client is, money's changing hands, and it's going to be this opportunity to build trust with them. It's going to be this opportunity to demonstrate your approach and show how smart you are and what a good problem solver you are and what a good strategic thinker you are. And what I want to say to that is you can do all of that with your marketing if you work at it. I'm not saying it's easy, but it is possible to do all of that so that when a client approaches you, if they've put in the time to see what you've done in your marketing, they're not going to have that many questions about what your approach is because they're going to have seen that demonstrated in your marketing and it's going to have been laid out for them. And so in that situation, it should be possible to say, we can talk for 30 minutes or an hour here and answer some questions. And I can certainly give you some detail during that conversation about how I might approach things in your case. But just go look at my website or just go to YouTube and search my name and you will see me talk a half dozen times about what we would do if we worked together. And satisfy your curiosity that way. And then if you want to get started, let me know and I'll send over an invoice. That is a little bit the situation where you have fairly productized services. So I know that doesn't entirely apply with big custom projects, but still, I feel pretty strongly about that point that if your clients have questions, answer those questions in your marketing. If they have questions that lead them to not trust you, find out what they are and answer them in your marketing. There we go. That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah, I agree. And even if you're doing custom projects, you can still divulge your overall thought process, right? Or your sort of guiding principles that would help a client decide. So like, if I'm moving from a pure sales training into some consulting projects that include sort of growth levers, one thing that I always want to communicate is, look, what I believe is you need to be partially a media company because one of the ways that you're going to differentiate from the competition is to showcase the way you think, the way you work, the work that you've done. And if you're not doing that, people just aren't going to pick you. Sorry. Like the whole market has changed. And so if you're not willing to do that, don't engage with me. because I don't think it's going to succeed, right? And so that would be an example of, even if you're selling custom engagements, like, how do you think about approaching these problems? That could be something you divulge in your marketing. So yeah, I don't mean to be too hard on the people who are advocates of road mapping. I guess I do mean to be hard on them. What I want them to think about is all of the other different things that could be addressed prior to figuring out like this perfect packaging of a $500 phone call, because I think there are lots of other things that could be addressed prior to that.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Like, if you're using road mapping as a way of compensating for something else, maybe there's a simpler, easier, better way to address that thing. And if you're not using it for that, then maybe you're using it for the right reasons.
Indeed, sir. Well, have you switched to net results yet?
No, I was starting the migration while we were talking, but I'm not done with it yet. I'm not sure there's any piece of software that has more lock-in for people like you and me than the email marketing software. What do you think?
Well, CRM is up there, but I guess you could consider your email marketing your CRM.
Yeah, they are vying for the top two spots, I think, in terms of switching cost.
It's tough, man. Yeah, I totally agree with you.
I'm in the middle of migrating from Drip to ConvertKit. I don't think I told you that.
So I saw that on Slack. Why don't we spend the last 5 minutes talking about that? Because I'm curious. Why'd you decide to change?
It was a straw that broke the camel's back situation. I got like one more email that said something was funky with my automation, which could be entirely my fault. And I will say that ConvertKit is offering me fewer ways to shoot myself in the foot than Drip when it comes to automation, because their automation engine is simpler. It has like fewer things that can trigger automation, fewer things you can do in automation. And that is 100% fine with me. And then Drip is just, I don't know, it just feels like post-acquisition by lead pages. It's not the same product and not as like responsive and easy to use. And I don't know, it just kind of feels in this weird, awkward middle place. And then finally, it's just a way to clean things up. I do that. It's wasteful. I know. I'll reinstall my computer from scratch. I'll like delete the hard drive, format it, reinstall it. Like, I do that with my laptop about every 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. It's just, it feels good to start from a clean sheet.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious why ConvertKit also.
Well, others have gone ahead, others in my sort of group of online consultant type friends, and they tell me that it seems better architected. And they seem to care more about deliverability and their support is better. It doesn't hurt that the first time I emailed ConvertKit support, this guy, Matt, gets back to me and he's like, hey, love your podcast. He's like a podcast listener of the Consulting Pipeline podcast.
Oh, so flattery killed you. They just got you there.
I'm loyal for life now that they flattered me once.
We all know how Philip works.
So I guess I'll have more to say about that. I've also like shifted my publishing workflow. So I now write my emails using this app called Bear Writer.
Oh, sure.
Uh-huh. Save them as a markdown file in a Dropbox folder. And then from there, automation does the rest. So a WordPress plugin pulls it from that folder, turns it into a scheduled blog post. It goes out at a certain time. And then there's an automation rule that you can set up in Drip. You can also set it up in ConvertKit and set up in MailChimp. That monitors an RSS feed, anything it finds there, it sends out as an email. So,
oh, I see.
I'm just trying to simplify, but temporarily making more work for myself by doing that. So it's a slow motion migration. I'm running both for several months until I make sure I like ConvertKit.
Interesting. Okay.
That's where the Coder to Consultant email course is located. Again, that's coder2consultant.com, the number two, not TO.
Thank you for that, Philip. Awesome. Yeah, I was curious because I'm on ActiveCampaign and I'm a pretty big advocate of it.
Still liking it, still feeling like it's the right tool for the job for you.
So,
Liston is shrugging. His elbows are over his ears right now.
It's good. It's really good. And it's for the price. Like, I don't know of another system that does as much as it does. I think it has some glaring weaknesses.
Sure.
But overall, it's pretty good. I think they all have the same problem, which is, the more complicated your automation gets, the harder it is to figure out like what happens when this happens and where are people, and it just starts to get complicated pretty fast.
Yeah.
So Yeah, I don't know. There are some things that I don't like about it. Like writing the automation sequences isn't the easiest.
Yeah.
Whereas I think ConvertKit has the best implementation of writing a sequence. So I don't know, man. I'm always curious because I too like to waste tons of time on tools. So thank you.
Shiny object syndrome.
Yes, sir.
But dear listeners, don't waste your time on road mapping if it's not right for you.
That's the takeaway here. All right, Philip, it was good to talk to you, sir.
You too. Bye.
All right. Bye.